Monster Man, bonus episode, June 2023. Hello, and welcome to Monster Man, a show about monsters, because monsters are great. I'm James Holloway, and I'm reading my way through the gaming books of yesteryear. And as I do, I'm taking a look at the monsters that I find in them, their history, their mythology, their ecology, their imagery, and how to use them in games. Today's episode is a bonus episode, going out to all of my Patreon backers at every level as a thank you for your continued support. In these bonus episodes, I just kind of talk about what I've been up to over the month, games I've been playing, things I've been reading, things I've been watching, etc., etc., and just kind of talk about whatever comes to mind, really. They're not very planned. This month has been a very busy month for me, mainly because I have been completing the Guide to Grunts, my zine month project from February. I had really hoped to get the physical copies into the hands of backers by the end of this month. I don't think that's going to happen. Well, in fact, I know that's not going to happen, but I'll post an update today or tomorrow. Today or tomorrow at the time I'm recording this. Actually, probably seen it already at the time you're listening to this, if you backed. But digital copies should be out, although I reserve the right to make later edits to the layout of the back cover if I don't like it. But people should be able to read it and use it, and that's, you know, the important thing. We're very close to being ready to go to press, but we're probably going to miss it. And by a little bit longer than a few days, because I'm going away for a couple of days in July. And then that means that I'm going to have to be doing a little extra work the week before that. So I'm disappointed, but, you know, we missed it, but we didn't miss it by very much. I mean, so far. So I feel reasonably okay about it. In addition to that, I've been getting ready for another LARP event, and I've been getting ready to host a game at Bring Out Your Lead, the annual gathering of the Old Hammer community in Newark. Well, technically near Newark, which is a surprising amount of work. I was thinking the other day, well, I have thought pretty consistently for the last few years, that what I'd really like is just a couple of weeks to write without deadline pressure and to, you know, paint and make things. I look at my friends and I see them making things, and that makes me very excited. But then, of course, it's hard to find the time to do it. Although I think I'm doing okay. I'm not trying to complain. I actually get quite a lot of time for hobbies. I just always want more. I have some vacations coming up, and that's good. But they're not the kind of vacations where I'm near all my stuff. And so I can't really make models, because that requires, you know, a huge amount of resources. Or at least an amount of resources bigger than you can take on a plane. Oh well. This is very much a first world problem. Okay. So, reading this month. So, I read a couple books this month. And I read a book called The Mysterious Mrs. Marie Corelli. Marie Corelli was, as the book describes her, the queen of the Victorian bestsellers. She was a hugely popular novelist in 19th century England. And that puts her into a class of people that I've always been very fascinated by, which is people who were very famous in their time and are forgotten now. Reverse Van Goghs or reverse Lovecrafts or whatever, right? So we have this inspirational myth of the artist who is hugely beloved now, but was unknown during their own lifetime. And these are people who, I mean, they're the opposite. Especially interesting because, in addition to just being a popular novelist, Marie Corelli seems to have been a bit of a character. And that's always fascinating. So I thought Marie Corelli was very interesting. I wasn't as wild about the book, which had a tendency to not really dig into the evidence for some of its parts. Perhaps it was just more stuff that could really fit into its scope. Anyway, it was interesting. I don't know that I'm necessarily going to return to it. I do think that another interesting thing about Marie Corelli in this context is that the stuff that she wrote was often pretty weird. There was a lot of stuff about her own idiosyncratic understanding of Christianity. I mean, I don't think she would use the term spiritualist, but there was a lot of kind of Victorian spiritualism in it. But yeah, she falls into that John Banvard category. If you're interested in those kind of people and you haven't read the book Banvard's Folly, I highly recommend it. It's a series of essays on people who were extremely famous during their lifetimes and then are not very well known now. Taking as an example, the American painter John Banvard, who was a huge deal in the sort of Victorian era. For the special episode on Chthonians, I read the Brian Lumley novel The Burrowers Beneath, which in that episode I didn't go into much detail about because That's not what the episode was about, but it's bad, and bad in, like, a number of different and almost conflicting ways. So I don't recommend it. It is, if you ever see it in, like, a charity shop or at a car boot sale or something, you can get it for a pound, then you should pick it up because it's sort of a curious piece of the history of Cthulhu Mythos fiction, which is sort of what I was looking for when I read Joshi's The Rise and Fall of the Cthulhu Mythos, which that's not really what it provided. It's just kind of a sort of rambling disquisition on Cthulhu Mythos literature, but, like, it doesn't, yeah, it's just what S.T. Joshi likes and doesn't like about Cthulhu Mythos fiction. Doesn't think about the whys at all. I read some comic books. The first volume of the DC comic Bombshells, which is bad. Like, you've seen Bombshells merch. It's sort of like DC Comics characters reimagined as, like, 1940s... Well, I was going to say, like, pinup or nose art, but they're not that risque. They're more like 1940s advertising mascots or something like that. And I thought, you know, I'll see what all the fuss is about, but whatever the fuss is about, it's not about this. I think that this is a comic that was based on, like, the merch line, and it is... It fascinated me, you know, I think, as counterintuitive as it might seem, I would say that the tenor of the Bombshell stuff is that it's all marketed primarily at female readers, and it's interesting to see how that reflected in what the authors were concerned about in their portrayal of the 1940s, but mostly it was just, I understand that comics writers are not historians, and that comics are written in a tearing hurry to hit very short deadlines. But still, like, that is just one of the inherent challenges of writing a comic set in a historical period. I realize it's like an alternate Earth, it doesn't have our history, but, like, no, it's just, they got Russians in it, but they just, like, talk like fantasy people, because that's what people talk like when they speak a foreign language, I guess. It's just, it's not great. Like, a lot of these things, it has a lot better concepts than it does actual story. Not recommended. I also read a bunch of the Jason Aaron run on Thor, God of Thunder, which I thought was pretty good. A big chunk of that got adapted into the film Thor, Love and Thunder, which is interesting in that it contains a lot of the same ideas, but tonally, it's very, very different. But I thought that was pretty good. Definitely had that sense of scale, which you want in a Thor comic, but nonetheless retaining some aspects of, like, humanity and character work. So in that respect, although I wouldn't say that it is similar exactly to Simonson's Thor, but in that respect, I think that's what made Simonson's Thor successful, and I think it also was present here. I'm in the middle of reading a game book. I'm actually in the middle of reading, like, four books. So I did this thing that I do. I don't get very much time to just sit down and read unless I kind of make myself. The Burrows Beneath is very short. And so I have all these things on the go that I'm reading in little chunks. Sometimes it'll take me months to finish one. And then it's like, oh, James read 10 books this month. Well, no, I just finished a bunch of ones that I've been reading for a long time. So I'm in the middle of a novel called, I think it's called Violent Stars, by the Canadian poet and science fiction author Phyllis Gottlieb. And I was partway through it, and it was all making, I mean, not making sense. It all felt weird and enigmatic, but I think that's what it's going for. And then I discovered that it is a sequel, and, like, the promotional language is very keen to make you understand that you don't have to have read the first one to understand this one, but somehow it still put me off my stride. I don't know why. That's just kind of how I responded to it. But I do intend to finish it, I just haven't got back to it. In the meantime, I started reading the Aykroyd novel Hawksmoor, which is about, you know, London church architecture. And that's been interesting, but again, you know, I'm reading it bit by bit. And then the most recent arrival is Zedek Sue's Reach of the Roach God, which is a, it's sort of a thousand islands, in that it's sort of system independent, has no sort of system content. It does do a certain amount of, like, benchmarking to try and give you suggestions for, like, how dangerous foes are relative to each other, which is fair enough. But without wishing to come off either as a tourist, which I guess I kind of am, or, like, a system doesn't matter guy, in general, we're not picking up Zedek Sue stuff because we're super excited about what his mechanical approach is going to be, right? It's just not what you think of when you think of him as a game writer. So I'm enjoying it a great deal so far. I don't know that I'm ever going to be able to run it, if only because I doubt I'm going to run another comparable fantasy campaign that has longer adventures. So one of the great things about Lauren's Song of the Bachelor, which is one of my favorite D&D scenarios, is that it is pretty brief. You know, it's got one plot concept, and it's quite... I mean, it has multiple interlocking B-plots, but they're all connected in a way that I think is very effective. You can run a couple sessions. This one, maybe not so much. And I'm midway through something else as well. Oh, A Biography of Paracelsus. I'm really getting nowhere with that one. But this is a bad habit. I still haven't finished Becky Ragg Sykes' book about Neanderthals. I just keep getting distracted. Now, this hasn't affected my film viewing. I listen to a podcast called Blank Check, and a lot of the time, the series of films that they discuss will kind of make me think that I want to see that movie, although only a couple of things stand out here as being suggested by that. But I watched quite a lot of films this month. There's a category on Netflix that you can search for, which is films less than 90 minutes long, which you can't see, but I just made the like chef perfect gesture. I approve of that. That's why I watched sort of 80s classic, but movie I'd never seen before, Stand By Me. It's really weird seeing John Cusack in this role where he's on screen for not 10 minutes and has half a dozen lines. But it was good. My heart was warmed. I watched the Buster Keaton classic Steamboat Bill Jr. Now, this is a film that was not very successful at the time that it came out. And in general, when people think of Buster Keaton, they think of his film The General. I really enjoyed Steamboat Bill Jr. I've actually never seen The General. And I think, you know, today, the fact that the hero is fighting for the Confederacy against the North probably would, like... I'm not saying like you can't enjoy it at all, but it does kind of add a weird sour note to the proceedings. I don't know. Maybe I'm wrong. I'm going to keep coming back to these silent films every now and again. I watched Beneath the Planet of the Apes, which, again, I'm working my way through the original Planet of the Apes series since I've never seen any of them. Beneath the Planet of the Apes is like a real boring retread of the original in the first half, and then some weird stuff in the second half. And the weird stuff is probably worth sitting through 45 minutes of James Franciscus. But, like, it's not amazing. And Escape from the Planet of the Apes, which I also watched, is, I'm gonna call it only so-so. I understand that it sets up a more interesting fourth film. So, we'll see if that's true at some point in the next few months. I watched The King's Man, which is a prequel to the Kingsman series of films, and doesn't have the thing that one would like about those films, right? Because the deal with The King's Man is... You know what? It's just a thing nobody was asking for. You know what I mean? I don't think anybody watched these movies, which are premised on irreverent 21st century youth slash cheeky working class chappy joins fancy pants old school British spy agency. Like, those movies are fine. They're fine. They're not, like, amazing, but they're sort of charming. And this is just, like, what if we gave that an incredibly convoluted backstory? It just... There's a scene in it where, spoilers for The King's Man, I suppose, Rafe finds his son, dies in the First World War, and he reads Dulce et Decorum Est in the church at his funeral. And it's meant to be this big, like, dramatic turning point where we all meditate on the horrors of the First World War. But, like, this is a movie that has, like, a big sword fight with Rasputin in it. And it's a prequel to a movie where, like, Samuel L. Jackson serves people McDonald's. Like, this is a farce. This movie can't bear that kind of weight. And it shouldn't have to. You know what I mean? It's just, who told you to make this franchise serious? These are comedies. So, in short, it's bad. But I knew that. I don't know why I watched it, really. Stuff gets put on the list, and then I experience a pleasure in clearing it out, even though the sensible way to clear it out would be to delete it. I watched Nicolas Cage vehicle The Unbearable Weight of Massive Talent, which is good. It's kind of the Cage version of JCVD in a way, but it's fun. I don't know that it says anything, like, it's not even Cage's best weird meta film commentary film, but it's fun to watch, and, like, Pedro Pascal just can't seem to miss lately, huh? I watched Nigerian historical epic Amina, or, depending on which character in the film you're following the pronunciation of, Amina, which is a story about a Hausa, like, princess from the 16th century who united her people to fight off a usurper and make peace with a neighboring polity and so on. So apparently she's quite a famous historical figure. This movie was okay. One of the things that was interesting about it, I've watched a few kind of Nigerian historical epic films, and or historical small scale films in some cases, but you know, Nigerian historical fiction. And they're a real mixed bag. There's something about the sort of predominant style of acting, especially among older performers, where I feel like the tradition of performance is more kind of theatrical in a way that doesn't necessarily translate well to film. And then the younger characters, so the younger performers who presumably come up in a generation in which there is this like very developed Nigerian film industry, you know, they have performances that feel more in line with what I'm used to. So I don't want to say that these other performances are bad. They're just not what I'm used to. But also the incongruity between actors who are, you know, using very different kind of idioms in the performances is jarring. Also, like, you know, it's expensive by Nigerian standards, but they don't really have the money for the big fight scenes and whatever. So, sure, you know, the choreography's not amazing or anything like that. But it was interesting. It's just interesting to see this kind of, like, it's not really romantic nationalism. It's just a pretty straight, like, historical drama about a culture where I don't know that much about the history. So it did make me want to go look stuff up about this place and period, which, you know, speaking of the podcast Blank Check, I was listening to a series about the films of Gina Prince Bythewood, which is why I watched The Secret Life of Bees, which is fine, I guess, but can't seem to decide whether it's like an issue film or a hangout film. And it is much more fun as a hangout film. You know what I mean? Like, I'm just going to sit here and chill with Alicia Keys and Queen Latifah and Sophie Okonedo and whoever, and Tristan Wilde. Hey, Tristan Wilde's from The Wire's in this. That's cool. And like, you know, those are all great actors, but then I wouldn't say it quite lands. And I think that that's the source material to some extent. I mean, I haven't read the book, but like, these seem like pretty fundamental aspects of the story rather than Gina Prince Bythewood's direction or whatever. Additionally, there's a great bit about love and caring and like the limits of those things within unequal relationships, which I thought was really interesting and was a great alternative to the more simplistic view that I think a lot of this kind of heartwarming films set in the 60s about African-American communities. Like, this is a film about a group of African-American women like nurturing a little white child, and you can absolutely see how that could have produced a very simplistic view of those relationships, and this one I felt was a little more clear-eyed, so that was cool. But I have to admit that I didn't like it as much as the other Gina Prince Bythewood film I watched this month, which was The Old Guard, that Netflix movie from a couple years ago, which was pretty good. It was better than I anticipated. I don't know that it changed my life or anything, but it's a well-made one of those, and I enjoyed it for the length of time I was watching it. I also watched terrible Billy Dee Williams comedy Secret Agent 00 Soul. That was a bad movie night. I usually don't include movies that I watch a bad movie night on this list, but it was just so weird that I thought I had to mention it a little bit. It can't even really make up his mind whether he's a secret agent or a private eye or what. Like everyone else, I watched Spider-Man Across the Spider-Verse, which I thought was good, although I understand there were some problems with its production that led to things like different versions of the film being in cinemas at the same time, and also ridiculous working conditions for the people who made it, which is far more concerning. I do think that this is a movie that, like its predecessor, gets what I like about superhero comics, and I think what a lot of people like, which is to say, these are films that are much more visually inventive and have much better visual storytelling than their live-action counterparts. They are more like a comic book, which is not to say that they don't have some kind of like distinctively film elements in them, but the things that I like about superhero comics are very present in these films, whereas I would say that's not always true for like a live-action Marvel or DC movie. Some are better than others, but definitely there's more of that feeling to this one. The pre-credits action sequence makes Marvel movies look like a bunch of old BS. I watched Spotlight, the film that won. Did it win Best Picture in like 2017 or something like that? I don't know why I didn't see this when it came out. I sort of went through a period, I think, where I kind of left mainstream drama behind. You know, I wasn't going to the cinema very often. This stuff doesn't really get promoted when it appears on streaming services. I feel like part of it was rising ticket prices, or at least my perception of rising ticket prices, where it's sort of like, well, in general, the kinds of films that I'm going to see in the cinema are ones where the cinema experience is really important. So, like, I'm going to go see the new Villeneuve's Dune Part 2. I'm going to go see that in the cinema because I really do think it'd be a very different experience watching it on television. Whereas Spotlight, I mean, I'm not saying it's badly shot or anything, but it's, you know, it's characters talking in rooms. That's not really what it's about. Anyway, Spotlight's about investigative journalists, and I like a newsroom picture. I think I said a couple of episodes ago that I like films set in offices in historical periods. Well, this is that, but like specifically if that office belongs to a newspaper, I'm even more down. So I like a newsroom picture. I don't know why. I did at one point aspire to be a journalist. Like I did journalism in high school and, you know, and sort of I thought that that might be where my career lay at one point, but it didn't really work out that way. Fortunately, maybe. Looking at the difficult job market of modern-day journalism, as opposed to the thriving podcast-slash-freelance game writer world, but just like a newsroom picture. Everybody in it's good. It's got a lot of those little moments where you're like, oh, hey, Paul Guilfoyle. I like seeing Paul Guilfoyle in things. I swear he doesn't age. I bet if I went and looked at, like, Paul Guilfoyle in this versus Paul Guilfoyle in L.A. Confidential, a film in which he has no lines, but he is in it, I would notice that he's different, but the sort of the impression that he gives is still the same 20-whatever years later. Speaking of things I watched because of Blank Check, they were doing a series on the films of Henry Selick, and as a consequence, I watched Selick's film Wendell and Wild. Now, I have liked the Henry Selick films I've seen in the past, which I think I've only seen the ones everyone's seen, right? Nightmare Before Christmas and Coraline. But I thought this was really good. It's really well animated. It's sort of visually cool. The performances I thought were good. The themes are, you know, relevant. The soundtrack's great. The plot is extremely convoluted and kind of, you know, I think you get the impression that this is a filmmaker who is more concerned about staging visually inventive scenes. It is mind-blowing to think that this is done with stop-motion animation. It must have cost the moon and stars. And as far as I can tell, it was released on Netflix without very much fanfare and sank without a bubble. But if you liked the previous two, I mean, and I know these aren't the only two, you know, but whatever. If you liked those previous two Henry Selick films, then I think you will like this one. Although I will say that its aesthetic is a little bit different, a little less goth, a little more punk, I guess. Anyway, I enjoyed that. So that's films. Okay. Games. So we're all here for. I don't know what the edit looks like, but I'm 30 minutes in by this point. I did watch a lot of movies this month. Anyway. Games. Scheduling conflicts have made it difficult to play in my RuneQuest game. In fact, as I'm recording this, the first session since the last time we talked is tonight, so I'm looking forward to it. I think it's going to be a lot of fun, but I cannot report on it. The D&D games that I'm running and playing in proceed apace. I'm currently running my party through Crypts of Indormancy, the weird art dungeon by Ezra Clavery, published by Melsonian Arts Council. It is fairly easy in my experience to take a lot of OSR materials and adapt them to 5th edition as long as they are, like, weird and creative enough. And as long as you are not at your table upholding certain assumptions that I think are very prevalent in 5th edition about fair fights or how exploration is going to go. You know, you just have to play it a little more loosey-goosey. But since my goose is extremely loose in the game that I run, I don't find adapting this stuff to be all that much of a challenge. Certainly the lethality is a lot lower than it would be if we were playing OSE. There's definitely encounters in the Crypts of Indormancy that I fully expect the whole party to survive, which I don't think the whole party would survive in a more traditional game, but they're going to be equally horrified, which is what's really important to me. D&D game that I play in, I think we're struggling a little bit with being quite high level. So we had a couple of rounds of pre-combat action, you know, before the rest of the party appeared during the raid that the PCs were conducting, during which the rogue of the party and my ranger we're just running around vaporizing people. And it's fine. It's cool. The idea of, like, you know, these guards just all disappearing one by one with a series of hurks, you know, as we worked our way up to the big guy. That's very cool and thematic. But I'm not saying I want it to end, but I do think that, and I know that we are near the end. I'm not saying I want it to end or, like, I'm looking forward to an ending, but I do think that it's fitting that it's ending because I don't know that we could necessarily go on all that much longer. I mean, we could, but you know what I mean? Like, I just think that we're at a satisfying point. Got to play in another session of the Call of Cthulhu game that I play in and run a session of my Rogue Trader game. These are kind of falling into monthly regular outings, which I like. Call of Cthulhu saw me narrowly avoiding death as a flying monster swept down on me while I was just walking down the street to go to a meeting. A meeting which apparently was an ambush. And now I'm in hiding. That's fun. It's tricky because modern Call of Cthulhu, which this is, I think is harder to manage than any of the historical periods. I think there's something about the grounding of the modernity. Like, the modernity can be jarring, and I think it works okay in this case. Like, our game is set in the 90s, so maybe it's not 100% modern, right? Maybe we're able to have a little bit of that distancing because we are talking about 25 years ago. I mean, I think it's working. I'm having a good time. I gotta say that I'm increasingly finding the Call of Cthulhu 7th edition system frustrating. And I actually think that if I were to go back and look at earlier editions, I might feel the same way. It's just that I'm so used to them. Like, I'm so used to Call of Cthulhu. I've played it so much and had it since I was a kid. You know, I think I bought my first Call of Cthulhu rulebook when I was 12 or 13. So I just feel like, I don't know, I feel like it's a little bit more complicated than is my usual taste, and the book is very big. It's not always easy to figure out what you're supposed to be doing, especially if, like me, you only play once a month. So I haven't had, like, the many, many repetitions to let the system bed in, after which point it wouldn't constantly be slowed down by, like, having to look things up. I feel like there's something else as well, but yeah, this month, you know, coming month July, I've got my LARP event. Quite looking forward to that. I'm making a lot of props for it. I wind up sort of making props for things. It's sort of my, you know, I don't really do costuming. Like, I'm not very good at that. You know, I tend to design characters who wear clothes you can buy in a shop. That's a very intentional part of how I thought about what my character wears. So I'm making these little, like, documents, and this game is set during an election campaign. So I'm making, like, posters and rosettes and badges and things. You know, I can do that, and it sort of helps me feel like I'm contributing, I guess. And then, of course, the month after that is going to be Boyle. I've been doing a good amount of painting. I painted a model that's for a Kickstarter being run by a friend of the show, Curtis Fell, Ramshackle Games. He does weird little creepy monsters. I actually, this didn't really occur to me, but, you know, weird little guys are having a sort of couple of years in the limelight. I think that people really like weird little guys, largely as a result of the Dark Souls games and their, you know, those influenced by them. And also, like, in the tabletop space, things like Mirkberg, and, you know, similarly as a trend within, like, the post-OSR indie gaming space. And I do think that that should hopefully be good news for Ramshackle Games, since Curtis has been making weird little guys as long as I've known them, kind of long before it was cool, right? It's like the ska band that suddenly became famous during that brief ska revival in the 90s. I hope that happens to him, you know? I hope he gets that ska band money, because his stuff is great, and the thing he was always doing has become popular. And I hope that that means more people pledge to his Kickstarter. All right, anyway, that's kind of what's been going on here behind the scenes. It's going to be a busy couple of months, but I'm looking forward to it. And same thing for the beginning of our new season. Right now, it's looking like it's probably going to be Al-Qadim, but who knows? It might change by Monday. But whatever it is, I'm going to announce it in Tuesday's episode, and then we're going to start the Tuesday after. And yeah, I'm excited about it. You know, I'm excited about seeing how these things were handled, and also if Al-Qadim is what it does turn out to be, or really any of the possibilities from that poll, these are going to be a bit shorter than Monster's Manual. That's going to be fun because I can cover a larger range of topics, which I think will help keep it fresh and interesting. So I'm really looking forward to it, and I hope that you are too, and I hope that you will join me then for Monster Man, a show about monsters, because monsters are great. Thank you for listening, and thank you very much for supporting Monster Man on Patreon. If you've got a favorite monster or something you'd like me to talk about, why not get in touch? I'm on Twitter as @GonzoHistory, on Mastodon as GonzoHistory@dice.camp, or you can find me on Instagram at MonsterManGonzo, or drop me an email, GonzoHistory@gmail.com. Our theme music is an extract from Solve the Damn Mystery by Jesse Spillane from the album Descent of the Goober Monster and is used under a Creative Commons Attribution License. Our cover art is by Ray Otis. Thanks for listening, and please join me next time for Monster Man, a show about monsters, because monsters are great.